Hey, long-time listener, first-time caller. Actually, I was at Dave's table at PAX. Nice guy, great game. But my message here was actually about ChatEDM's bit on the first podcast, the mouse guard stuff. I love it. I'm going to go try it in my game coming up this weekend. I'll let you guys know how it goes. I'm expecting a little bit of adjustment there, so my third or fourth session will probably go better than my first. But great idea. Thank you guys a lot. Keep up the good work with the new podcast, and I hope it goes on for a long, long time. Anyway, thanks a lot. Bye.
This is the Dungeon Master Guys. Dungeon Master Guys.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Dungeon Master Guide podcast. I'm your host, ChatEDM, along with my co-host, Dave the Game. Hey Dave, how are you doing?
Hey, good to be here.
Newbie couldn't join us this week because we sent him to the source to get a new mic, but he's going to be with us next month. We have a great show lined up for you this month. We're going to have an interview with Wolfgang Bauer, who's going to discuss his approach to using published adventures into your own homebrewed games. Then we're going to have a new BDM, if we can find him, who's going to discuss his narrative techniques to improve his various game sessions. And then you are going to tell us about...
I'm going to tell you about some ways to cut down in length of combat by inserting some ways that it can end early. But before we get to our first segment, I'd like to take a minute to talk about our new sponsor, Obsidian Portal. They are going to be helping us pay some of the bills around here, and they're one of my favorite DMing tools anyway, so it seemed like a great fit. And so here's Obsidian Portal.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
Yeah, I could sure use that, like in my next game. So let's start right now with trying to trick my nemesis, Wolfgang Bauer, into sharing with us all his dirty secrets about published adventures.
After toiling for long years, I finally lured my nemesis, the Lord of Fluff and King of Kobolds himself, Wolfgang Bauer, to my lair of crunchy rules and game mechanics. He thought it was for a simple discussion. But I had dire plans for him. There's no escape for you now, Mr. Bauer. Today I have a very special guest. He's been working either through being a game designer, an editor, a freelance writer, on various iterations of the D&D games since, I think, 1991, from TSR to Wizards of the Coast, through Paizo and his own... Alta, a studio called Open Design. I have with me today Wolfgang Bauer. Thanks for welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for making me feel antique. It's been 20 years in D&D.
Yeah, well, you've been doing it for a long time, and I've been doing it on my side as a player gamer for about 27, so we don't get any younger.
No, we don't. But we have fun with it, so we keep going.
Exactly. The reason why I invited you... on my segment of the show, it was that I wanted to discuss with you how to adapt published adventures, because you've done a lot and you've seen a lot over your years working on so many. I make a point of making you feel old, right?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
You mean experienced, skilled, and cunning, full of plans.
That's why they call you the Master of Fluff. I wanted to discuss with you how we would adapt, published adventures to different campaigns, because a lot of masters are met with the challenge of having a published adventure that does not exactly fit their campaign, but they don't necessarily feel like they should do it. And I wanted to start maybe with the first example that I lived as a Dungeon Master, and we can talk, because it was one of your adventures, or one adventure you worked on, which was Expedition to the Demon Web Pits for D&D 3.5.
Right, with Gwendolyn Kestrel.
Yes. At the time, I wanted to have an adventure set in Tolos, and I tried, and I really, really wanted to set most of the adventures in that particular setting written by Monty Cook. And mm-hmm. I hit a lot of walls, because a lot of the adventure is set in, Sigil, right?
Right. Yep. And a lot of it's Planescape specific, and of course, in the Abyss. So... doesn't necessarily fit right into Tullis, although I think there are some similarities. But the differences are the ones that stick out. I mean, I ran into this all the time when I was editing Dungeon Magazine. People would write in and complain that we wrote some films and that meant they weren't allowed to use it in their home campaign, or that they would need to modify it.
Right.
So the problem comes up all the time. And the first thing you need to realize is that, yeah, these adventures are meant to be played and adapted to the needs of your group. And if you've paid money for an adventure, it's yours to do with as you like. Certainly no one at Wizards of the Coast is going to come after you and say you didn't play it the way we wrote it.
Well, we've got it on a good account that the Wizards of the Coast police was disbanded a few months ago.
Yes, exactly. They've been disbanded. It was a cost-saving measure, so they're not coming after you. And you can rip out the parts you like and drop the parts you don't. One of my rules when I'm working on open design projects is make it as generic as possible and keep the background short. And the reason is, over years of experience as an editor, I've seen time after time people say, keep it generic so I can use it in my homebrew. And most campaigns out there aren't, in fact, Greyhawk or Tullis or anything else.
Exactly.
They're someone's homebrew. I mean, that's the majority, although Wizards wouldn't want you to believe that, or Paizo or anyone. They want you to use their homeworlds. But, in fact, most are homebrews, so you should feel you're in good company. And then I would say, yeah, most adventures that I'm responsible for editing or designing, keep the background short so that it's easy to do what you're proposing, namely rip the background up and throw it away and just keep the first hook and use, you know, that first hook as the point where you start and ignore all that city description of Sigil or Zobek or wherever it happens to be.
So if you would try to put yourself in the shoes of, an experienced DM, what parts of an adventure would you attack first to adapt it? So you mentioned already the plot.
Yeah, I mean, I would throw away most of the background and say, let's start at the first hook and place that hook somewhere in the setting with appropriate NPCs. You know, if it's, Mordenkainen in a Greyhawk adventure, replace that NPC hook with...
another wizard in your own campaign.
Right, you know, just swap out NPCs madly. Kings and queens and whatnot are, well, they're not interchangeable, but they're all authority figures. Just swap in one for the other.
A king can become a sultan. Yeah,
exactly. Then once you're past that first hook, and I mean, you as the game master know better than anyone what's going to work with your group. Once they're hooked and off on the adventure, often there's a momentum to it. Where the plot does carry them through from encounter to encounter. They find a clue, they see the bad guy or his minions, and there's less adaptation needed there than at the start. So I'd say mostly focus on starting it upright. Then, of course, you got to go through and look for all of the things that, you know, aren't going to work for your group for other reasons. And I guess I'm intruding on Crunchlord territory here a little bit, but I'd say mechanically, right? You want the mechanics to actually play off the party well. If your party is full of, I don't know, some optimized 3.5 undead turning sun god cleric who's just going to blow through the undead sections, well, let him blow through the undead sections. Right? I mean, don't take that away from him, but just know.
Or if there are no undead section, you could add one or two encounters or switch some of the monsters around to fit that particular expectation.
Exactly. And that may be that player's moment to shine, right? He may say, oh, wow, that was a 5-minute encounter because I just blew that all away. Well, great. That's terrific. But on the other hand, if you've got a bunch of, heroic tier 4th edition characters who are optimized for melee, and they don't have any, I mean, it's 4th edition. They don't have fly at 10th level. Mm-hmm. They've got
jump for 6 seconds at 10th level.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe they don't have a lot of ranged attacks, and you're going through the section, you're saying, wow, look at this Elvish Archers or Drow section. It's all ranged attacks. It's all artillery. Huh. And then think about it hard, right? Do you throw that at the group anyway, knowing that it's going to be really hard and they might get beat up a lot? Or do you say, I'm going to dial it back from a 10th level encounter to an 8th level encounter just so they don't get turned to hamburger here?
Exactly.
So mostly it's knowing your group, knowing both what are they going to respond to in the game world, right? Give them some Tullus NPCs if that's what they've been playing with. Bring back some of those guys early. And then mechanically, is this going to match up to their skill set? And then the last thing, I mean, you'll notice both of those are oriented at the players. The last thing I'd recommend is change the things that bother you in terms of your setting.
That's right? Actually very important, because whenever I read a published adventure, there's always a part, maybe a section or an encounter that I'm not comfortable with, that I can't even imagine how I would DM it. Even though I've been doing it for 25 years, I feel that it's a weaker part of my skill set, and it's going to be hard to pull it.
Right. And you should go with that feeling, right? If it's a pet peeve and you're just going to stand behind the screen going, God, I hate this encounter, your players are going to sense that, right?
Exactly.
Or if it's just a kind of encounter that you don't like a, drawn out, poisoning encounter or something, you can say, nah, my players are going to hate this, and I hate this, so let's just not do it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with dropping encounters, right?
Or swapping them out, or even stealing from another adventure.
Exactly. I mean, you may or may not be comfortable building a complete Frankenstein's monster out of a published adventure and putting all sorts of other things in it. If you're a relatively experienced dungeon master, you may want to run it by the book with one or two changes. Mm-hmm. But you should always feel comfortable that, hey, it's yours to adapt.
And it gets easier with time.
Oh, it totally does. I mean, there are some encounters which I change on the fly during playtest sessions, because it's like, oh, I really missed a bet here, or the designer didn't get this right. And there are other encounters I run pretty much by the book, do the read aloud, use the same stats. Wow, that was so much easier than prepping it all myself.
And if you must know, we ended up doing Expedition with the final fight against the, I think you had two avatars of Loth in there.
Uh-huh.
And it ended up destroying the universe and fusing the Feywild, yes. Or fusing the fairy world with the main physical world and creating the 4E section. The 4E world.
Woohoo!
So there you go.
That's perfect. That's the grand kind of epic finale I was hoping for out of that adventure.
Actually, one of my friends wanted me to annotate the book so that I could give it to you at Gen Con, saying the modifications I'd done to it.
Well, that is certainly one that I think needs modifications. I think I've told this story before. Expedition to the Demon Web Pits was a project I couldn't resist, but I also couldn't do justice to, because I was given about 60 days to write it. Yeah. And for a book of that length and that complexity, I love the setting, right? I mean, it's Gygax, it's first edition, it's wonderful. But I wanted about 6 to 8 months to write that adventure, and I had two.
So. Well, there was enough material so we could run with it, so it was totally worth it. So
there are whole sections in there that I hope people rip off blatantly and use, right? And there are other sections I'm like, gosh, I hope somebody modifies that when they run it.
I can tell you my players were sick and tired of hearing me talking in Trinary. Especially in French. All right, Wolfgang, it was great having you on the show.
Glad to do it.
It was fun talking to you, and don't forget, when you leave, take door number 3.
Door number 3? Ha ha, you have tried to fool me again. I'm taking door number 2.
Oh, damn. I'll forget you next time, Mr. Bauer.
I'll get you next time.
All right, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it seems that I've been completely unable to convince my nemesis to step in the trap. So, how did you tell me to arrange my traps next time?
You should probably do it so that it actually, you know, keeps him there and actually kills him instead of giving him all these chances to escape.
Yeah, but it's kind of fun to, you know, give him a chance. You know, maybe I'm too much of a softy. Up next, we've got newbie DM who's going to tell us about tips for effective narration.
All right, so you're a new DM. You're sitting at the table. Your players are all waiting for you to start, and you're looking over your screen. You got your minis, you got your maps, you got everything ready to go, and you haven't started talking yet because you're nervous, because you're a little scared, because it's the first time you do this, and you're not sure how you're going to sound. You're not sure what you're going to say. The first time you DM, it can be really scary. I remember I did it. It was very scary. All the attention is on you. I had 14 eyes looking at me, waiting for me to start. And it was kind of intimidating, I have to admit. It's an intimidating thing. It's a little daunting. But once you get the hang of it, it could be fun. The first thing you got to remember is that you're playing a game. You're not giving a lecture on global warming. You're not teaching people how to perform surgery. You're playing Dungeons and Dragons. You're killing dragons. You're pretending to be elves and dwarves. Keep that in mind. You're playing a game. Okay? Don't take it too seriously. If you're playing with friends, they're going to laugh at you sometimes. They're going to mess with you. Take it in stride. It's a game. It's fun. Okay, so when you start describing things, what are some of the tricks you need to do to be effective? And effective, you're trying to communicate. So when you describe things, represent the five senses. Remember, people have five senses. Use them all when you're describing. They need to know the details of the world. If you're narrating a scene where, you know, your characters are walking through a field, don't just tell them they're walking through a field of yellow flowers. Tell them what the flowers smell like. Tell them what the air feels like as it touches their skin. You know, your players, the characters need to know what the world around them looks like, feels like, and smells like. Dungeons have a smell too. Fill them in on all the essential details. That's one of the main things about being effective. Be detailed, not overly so. You don't want to bore people. Remember, if you write flavor text and you're going to read off flavor text instead of ad-libbing a narration, that's perfectly fine. That's what the flavor text is there for. It's for you to read it. Try to read it in a natural manner. Don't sound so monotone. Don't sound so practiced at it. Don't sound so rehearsed, is what I'm trying to say. And when you write these things, keep yourself in check. Be your own editor. The awesome text you wrote can probably be shortened down a bit. Remember, nobody wants to sit there and listen to a DM who's reading a wall of text. That gets boring very quick. Give him the necessary flavor. Give him the necessary descriptions. Give him what they need to know and move on. Yes, you might be Shakespeare. Nobody wants to hear that. Okay? Nobody wants to hear you reading a novel. One important thing is that you need to be the center of attention. Everyone at the table has to be looking at you when you're narrating. If someone's busy texting or playing on the phone, then you're doing something wrong. Okay? When I'm DMing, I try to ham it up. I'm loud, I'm expressive, I'm memorable. I'm Latin, so I speak a lot with my hands. I move my hands a lot. I slam the table. I'm very physical. I try to exaggerate the tone of voice of the NPCs. I try to act. I make funny voices. Oh, hello. Yes, I am the NPC you're meeting. Oh, yes. Or the bad guy sitting at the bar. What do you want? What do you need? I have the info. You have the gold? That type of stuff. Ham it up. Be a clown. You know, that's what you're there to be, memorable. You're there to be the DM who's going to be talked about afterwards. You're going to be the DM who's going to create characters that people remember afterwards. If you're in the middle of a narration, don't allow rules discussions to break it up. It'll grind your game to a halt and break the immersion. Deal with it later and move on. Keep narrating. Tell everybody to be quiet. You keep doing your thing. And then when the game's over, you guys discuss the rules. But good narration should not be interrupted by rules lawyers. Okay, and here's another important thing. Decide whether you're speaking and treating your game in the first person or the third, and stick to it. Be consistent, because consistency helps you build a comfort level. If it's always, "I'll get you, meddling kids," rather than "he snarls and he says he's going to get you, meddling kids," then keep it that way for the long haul. And finally, don't be Ferris Bueller's teacher. A monotonous DM, no matter how great his encounters are, is hard to sit through. You don't want sleepy players, you want energetic and involved players. So lead by example. So I hope these tips help you out in your DMing. Remember, be descriptive, not overly so, but give everybody their five senses. Be animated, be the center of attention, be loud, be expressive, ham it up. You're acting. You're playing these NPCs, make these NPCs memorable, okay? Don't allow rules discussions, and have a good time.
So that was newbie's tips for keeping things kind of lively at the table, among other things, with descriptions. I agree with most of what he said there. I too, even though I'm not Latin, talk with my hands a lot and try to do voices. In fact, I heard Chris Perkins talk about doing voices once, and he said he just thinks of a Futurama character and kind of steals that for every NPC he uses. So whatever kind of trick you need to pull up a new voice or a new expression, I think helps in the midst of running.
My players used to say that the only voice I could pull off, because I would try to do voices, was doing a fat Lebanese merchant, and which is kind of true. But ever since I've played with James Wyatt at Gen Con, and I've seen that you don't look half as stupid as you think when you do crazy voices, I've been doing it a lot. And even though your players look at you funny in the first minute, they get really into it afterwards. So yeah, the voices, the hamming up is a great sets of tips. I totally agree.
And I think what Newbie's saying is that you really can't be concerned that your players are going to think you're crazy. You know, you may look like an idiot, but that's kind of the point. You know, that makes it memorable.
Yeah, I totally agree. But speaking of memorable, a lot of people playing the latest version of D&D are having troubles with fights that run too long. And according to what you told me about before the show, you wanted to tell us about this.
Yes, I have a solution. So let's take a listen.
All right.
All right. One of the most common critiques of 4E is the length of combat, and it's certainly one that I've encountered firsthand enough times. However, I've come up with a method that keeps the length of combats down. It's not specific to 4E either, and it's definitely not complicated. In every combat, I build in what I call outs. These are ways to end a combat before one side or the other has lost all hit points. One of the most common outs is if a leader dies. Like in a war game, when a force fails a morale check, if the commander or a majority of forces is killed, the grunts decide to flee. If you have a bad guy who sicks his lackeys on the PCs, the lackeys might decide to take off with their fee if the boss is killed. There are lots of other examples, too. Not every creature fights the death, so maybe they begin fleeing when bloodied or injured. And then, of course, their companions call them cowards as they run past. Maybe the enemies are there to take something from the PCs and focus their attacks on that. Maybe they're just trying to stall the PCs for a certain amount of time and then withdraw once the time is up, leaving the PCs to wonder, hey, what just happened? Here's what I recommend for just about every combat. Get inside the mindset of the monsters you will be running. Ask yourself how they would respond to the PC's presence. What are their goals? What do they want? How do they feel? The answers to these questions will not only tell you when they will surrender or try to leave combat, but also makes your combats more dynamic and contribute to the story of the game. It also injects more role-playing into a situation where it's easy just to fall back on rules. And, as was the goal up front, it'll cut down on the length of your combats, as opposed to just grinding out all the HPs from everyone on one side. You don't always have to plan for your outs, either. If it occurs to you during a fight that something would happen to end the fight, make it happen. Or even if you feel like a particular fight has overstayed its welcome, and your players are starting to get bored and you want to get on to the next thing, come up with an in-story reason to cut the fight short. While this may seem obvious, it's easy to get caught up in the mode of, this balanced fight that I spent time crafting needs to run to completion. Rarely is this actually the case, and that you need to absolutely finish this fight in the normal way. Just keep an eye out for what makes sense in the story and what's fun, and it'll all come naturally. So if you have any other suggestions for us on outs for combat, do let us know.
You know, Dave, after listening to that, I've been DMing for about 25 years, and I often forget to give monsters other options and just try to slay the PCs. Sometimes I get caught in when I design, I get caught in, you know, trying to be too clever, and I forget that monsters can abandon or can run away or can decide. So they're all a great set of tips. Although sometimes the players will want to see it to the end. Do you use them often, those tricks?
Pretty much every combat, just about. Some of them will end by just killing all the monsters anyway, but I always try to have in mind how the fight's going to play out, like what the monster's motivation is in the fight. So that, you know, some of the time they will just fight to the death, but I try not to make that the default option.
All right. Since the last show, we got a few comments and a few calls for us to answer, and we've chosen two for this particular show. So can you start it up, Dave, please?
Yes. So from one email that we received, it was Dragon Master Kale, who was talking about his Diceless Star Wars game that's kind of based on the Amber Diceless game. The system's not really important. The kind of what the problem boils down to is that two of his players have started to fight in game. It was always kind of there's a level of tension between them, but one of them made a concerted effort during a fight to kill the other one. And so now it's kind of outright hostilities. And Dragon Master wanted to know, how do you fix this problem without breaking up the party or forcing one of them to make a new character? You know, what if they love their characters, they just happen to hate one of the other player characters? You know, what do you do?
Well, that's kind of a hard... It's a kind of a hard choice because everybody's... Both players are against the wall and they really hate each other. My first answer would be, I mean, how far are the actual players willing to go with this? And,
yeah, exactly.
And they should, you know, both side face to face with the DM, maybe in a separate place where the other players aren't, discuss it. Where should we send this? And is there any way for us to A, salvage the party, or if we can't salvage the party, make it one cool final confrontation?
Yeah, and maybe even you don't know how that's going to play out, or the players don't.
Yeah.
Know how it's going to play out, but you're right. I think buy-in from the players is extremely important in that situation. I mean, if the players themselves are the ones who are arguing and not just their characters, you've got another problem that needs to be dealt with.
Yes.
And then you sort of have to put on the, you know, game master as group facilitator hat to deal with that, which, you know, basically will come down to saying like, hey, you guys need to cool it off, or,
yeah,
you know, some other social thing.
And doing it away from the group as a, you know, one-on-one with a mediator already present. Look, if they don't agree to do what we talked about a few minutes ago, then the occasion is perfect to talk it out. Well, you know, guys, give me a solution so that I don't actually kick one of you guys out of the game. And that usually helps things out.
And say that you'll kick both of them out if they don't clean up their act, you know?
And they go, fine, I'll find another dungeon master.
Right.
Which is like all game master's secret fear. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so,
in some situations. But, you know, if they're going to be disruptive, there's really not a whole lot you can do at that point. But all that said, if it turns out that, like, no, they're just really into these characters and they're not bringing that ill will out of the game, you know, they can even... go on doing that, you know, maybe it'll, like, as long as they have a common mission. Yep. And are working together in the game, then it'll keep playing itself out and maybe the conflict will resolve itself.
Yes.
You know, in some way. But if it's not derailing your game, you can sort of have that keep going.
Yeah, totally agree. Next.
Yes, we have a comment that was left on the last show by Jardine. And it's about combat, and Jane says wants to use unique monsters and try to keep things interesting, but it just gets boring a lot of the time. There's not enough terrain there. He wants to put some interesting things, like some of the terrain stuff from DMG 1 and 2, but is having a hard time explaining it other than, hey, it's magic, it does this thing. You know, how do you spice it up without being pretty lame, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's while the last edition of the game, the 4E game, really makes it look like it's a science to design cool encounters, it's still a lot of an art. And describing, especially the new Terran features, describing them can be kind of hard, but I think you need to go into and steal from action movies. So whenever you see someone exploit, you know, a pile of rocks or make a tree fall on character, on the bad guys or whatnot, this is probably what you need to focus on. There are simple tricks. So you can have whatever, a tree or saplings that you can pull back and then throw against, you know, small monsters so that they're pushed back. There are different kinds of tricks that you could use. So I would think about that.
Yeah, and... along both of those lines, you really can just think about mundane terrain features that are still really interesting. I mean, you know, a tree branch is not magical at all, but could have this one effect, or a well that you can kick someone down.
Totally.
You know, that's not anything magical, and players automatically know, oh, I can shove the monster down there, you know, and the monster is going to try to be shoving me down there.
Yeah. Or when or when in doubt, just add a fire pit.
Yep, exactly. Fire makes everything better, so fire or explosions.
And ninjas.
And ninja. Well, I don't know if I would make ninjas a terrain feature, but
well, yeah, all right, fair enough. fine.
But fire, explosions,
dead ninjas,
static ninjas who sit there in a square and attack.
Yeah,
you know, maybe they just stand there and they throw shuriken.
There you go.
Yeah, but I would say just trying to play up some of the more mundane ones, and if you want to use a more magic one, then you can make that more central to the story. Like if they're going up against a spellcaster, then it's going to make more sense that they have these magical traps or defenses or whatnot.
Yeah, runes, rune portals, or even little pieces of the elemental chaos showing in and being there as having been summoned by the bad guys or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and what I would recommend is looking up some of those, like in the different D&D books, and working backwards. Instead of saying, okay, here's my combat, how do I splice it up with terrain? Start with a piece of terrain, like a piece of the elemental chaos. Say, okay, what encounter can I build around this terrain feature? And make that the focus. So, you know, it's kind of inherently interesting, but at the same time, you're integrating all these other things into it to make it seem like a consistent encounter.
Yeah, and as a last bit of advice, I would, if you've got any kind of battle maps or dungeon tiles at home, you can just look at them and look at some of the features there and just try to imagine one mechanic that would affect the fight, which is this one. You just create that one and you use it, and it can lead to really interesting results.
Yep, I agree completely. I love those maps. I love those tiles.
You know, I so do I. Well, this is the end of our show. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed doing it. And we'll see you again next month. In the meantime, you can leave us comments through various channels. Why don't you tell us, Dave, please?
Well, you can send an email that will get directly to us by sending it to dmg@critical-hits.com. Or you can go onto the website, which directly is dmguys.net, or go on to critical-hits.com and look for the little podcast drop-down menu. And you can leave a comment on any of the shows that we've done. You can also call in and leave a message on Newbie DM's voicemail. Any DM questions can go to 305-349-3026. That's 305-349-3026.
And that concludes episode 2 of the Dungeon Master Guide podcast. We thank you very much for tuning in. And once again, we wish to thank our sponsor, Obsidian Portal. Thank you very much, and see you next time.